Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. I would like to welcome listeners to this week's edition of University Matters on Campus FM. I'm privileged to have with me today an historian who really needs little introduction, Professor Henry Frendo. Professor Frendo is well known for his extensive writing on Malta's modern history. I need only mention a few of his works that he has written and others to which he has contributed. There's, of course, Europe and Empire, Culture, Politics and Identity in Malta and the Mediterranean, which I've had the pleasure of discussing with him on this program before. Zminlinglisi, Il Secolo d'Satash, The Origins of Maltese Statehood, Malta Cultural Identity, and his very well-known 1979 Party Politics in a Fortress Colony, The Maltese Experience. He's also, of course, had a fascinating career that has taken him to far-flung lands. Professor Frendo was employed with UNHCR years ago and was stationed in such places as Switzerland, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Egypt, and Papua New Guinea. As his books suggest, his main areas of research and interest are imperialism, nationalism, decolonization, post-colonialism, journalism, migration and ethnicity in Central and Eastern Europe, the Mediterranean, the Middle East and North Africa, especially since 1798. He's also much interested in bilingualism and the relationship of language to nationality, culture and statehood. Welcome to you, Professor Frendo.
Thank you very much indeed.
Today, of course, we're here to discuss his latest book, entitled Demek's Lost Prison Poems, published by Mitzi Books and recently launched at Saint-Antoine Palace when the President of the Republic gave the concluding speech, and there were interventions by several other well-known academics. This is not the first time that I've discussed this historical and literary figure here on University Matters, precisely because, I suppose, he represents both Malta's history and also literature. Before talking about this new research, perhaps you could remind our listeners of the background and, frankly, inauspicious beginnings that Manuel Demek had.
Yes, well, I became intrigued by mention of this personality during an interview I had with Gino Muscadazzo Pari at his residence in Sulema, because I noticed that when he mentioned his name, he lowered his voice. And I had never heard of him. So he was confiding in me, you know, some information which most people either knew nothing about or because of the very strong existing stigma would not mention it, he would not say anything about it. So I went about trying to discover any survivors who had known this person, which I did. I was lucky because I did my BA degree in history on a social background to the Maltese labor movement, in which my first references to Demek appear, but obviously this was just an aperitif. Then I did my honors thesis on him, which is much, much more substantial, and I must say, surprisingly, it earned me a first class. It was an external exam from Oxford, but Professor Androvella, I must say, was a Dominican father, was very encouraging, and I, you know, I owe him a lot, really. So from then on, I did my MA about the language question, and then subsequently my doctorate at Oxford, in which I publish some quite revealing manuscript sources relating to Demek. They're in part the Politics in a Fortress Colony. The third edition came out some months ago, including some fairly skeptical points about what the Roman Catholic Church hierarchy had done to Christ, to Christianity, you know, to the essential Christ. So anyway, then I mentioned the Demekiani for the first time in a little book on the Sette Giugno in 1970, because 1969 was the 50th anniversary of the Sette Giugno, and to my utter amazement, in a finalist's quiz on TV for school children, nobody had ever heard of the Sette Giugno, let alone Demek.
Quite so.
So I said, there's something very wrong in this country. So then I tried starting a series of articles on Demek based on my honors thesis, basically, in El Haya, which by then I had been invited to edit. which was a daily Roman Catholic newspaper, which, however, had a statute and a board of directors, and it was supposed to be an independent newspaper. But, you know, independence in this country, in journalism, is a very tall order. And no sooner had the first article appeared that I did not find the Archbishop and the Auxiliary Bishop in my office in the morning when I went to work at 7:30 in the morning, and they were both sitting at my desk, furious. And I was ordered by Archbishop Gonzo to stop writing about this person who was an antichrist immediately. I said, listen, I said, I've promised the readers that I was going to publish a series about him, not one article, you know. So I said, but look, we'll do 1 week and then close it. So I published the series for a week and then abruptly ended it. But then I thought, you know, it deserved publication in book form. And as I was working at the Catholic Institute, which was where my office was, and downstairs there was the Empire Press. The Empire Press was the Catholic Church's press, the Empire Press. So I went downstairs and said, look, I said, I would like you to publish this book for me. There was a chap called Dunaronne who was in charge of this Empire Press. He said, okay, you took all my manuscripts and all my illustrations and everything. And there was an election approaching in June 1971, so for sales purposes I was hoping to have this book published before the election. As the press seemed to be dragging its feet, and I was getting a bit annoyed, you know, I eventually went down to Father Aaron and said, listen, I said, I want my manuscripts back because you're taking too long and I would like to publish this. He said, well, he said, I'm afraid you will have to go to the Archbishop's palace to retrieve them. I said, what? Who told you to give them to him? He said, well, that's where they are. So I went to the Archbiscopal Paris, or whatever it's called, Archivescovili, Palazzo Archivescovili in Archbishop Street in Valletta. And I was met by Bishop Gerada. He had a whole huge desk there with sprawling designs of villas in Santa Maria State and so on. And then on top of them, the manuscripts, my manuscripts. And I said, those are the manuscripts of my book about the making. I said, can I please have them back because I want to publish a book about it? He said, no, you are the editor of our newspaper. I said, you cannot publish. I said, well, in that case, give me back my manuscripts and then we'll see later. He said, no, but you cannot be the editor of our newspaper if you publish this. Certainly not before the election. So, to cut a long story short, I took my manuscripts back and he terminated my job, and just as my father had died, actually. So I spent a year in the queue at the labor office, you know.
what was so terrible about
it? Was excommunicated. He had been excommunicated, you know. It seemed like an act of defiance that somebody should speak of him in favorable terms, in positive terms, you know. He had been excommunicated because he had dared question certain practices rather than beliefs of the church.
So he ended up in prison. He was illiterate in prison.
Well, that's a very good point, because in fact Professor Joseph Brinkard brought it up also at the launch at St. Anton, and he said, had he ever been to elementary school, did he at least know how to read and write? Because it's quite incredible that after a few years in prison, this person was writing poetry in three languages in impeccable orthography. I haven't seen any school attendance registers. I mean, there was a school in Valletta. Whether he ever attended, I don't know. He was an orphan. He was a street urchin, a scunizzo, you know. He was picked up several times by the police for petty thefts and so on before he was accused of complicity in a brutal murder, a bloody murder, in Floriana, just in the tunnel there below the Porte de Bombe. And he was saved from the gallows by his age, because he was 17. The other fellow was hanged. So that was a merciful act of providence, I guess, given the what happened later.
But the clerics, the chaplains, even if he had been to elementary, let's presume for a moment that perhaps he did know how to read and write, but certainly what he produced in prison and afterwards and was the fruit of research, of reading, that really goes beyond even the sort of normal.
I think in a sense, prison has done this to a lot of people. You know, some of the greatest works of literature, you know, have been produced from prison. You know, from Dostoevsky to Silvio Pellico. You know, so prison can, if you have a native intelligence and a will to reform, prison can be a great place because you have time to yourself. You can meditate. You can introspect. There was some kind of a prison library which I had visited at the time that I started researching on the Mac to see what he could have read, you know. For example, Silvio Pellico's Le mie prigioni were in the library, you know. Dante Alighieri was standard fare at the time, you know, the Mac knew it by heart. But yes, he had some tender loving care from the pastor there and the curator. There was a Maltese one and eventually, I think, and also a Protestant one, wisely. But I'm not sure if in this early stage, because we are here, when the Mac is barely 21 years old, and he says in one of his poems that he was not even 22 years old, you know, when he was writing it. This was a kind of emulation of the Divina Commedia, a kind of with the cantos and so on. very evocative of Dante Alighieri, in fact, almost plagiaristic, not quite, but evocative. So I don't see any Protestant influence in these earliest writings, you know. For example, he has a poem to the Blessed Virgin, Stabat Mater, which is classic Roman Catholic eulogy of the Blessed Virgin, you know, very pious, in fact. But I think at a later stage he would have become perhaps more critical and also more influenced directly by the scriptures rather than by the preaching about them.
He spent time in prison here, but then was also sent to prison elsewhere.
But that's much later.
Much later.
That's much later. He his first stint in prison was until 1890. Then he went off on a stint to Tunis. Then went back to prison on his return, accused of uttering counterfeit coin at some Melich, a grocer shop. I don't know if he knew it was counterfeit or not. I think he had problems surviving, frankly, you know, was trying to buy some bread or stealing an apple. In those days, if you stole an apple from the market in London, they'd transport you to Australia. So far in this early part, you know, Dumas comes across more innocently, you know. There's a lot of introspection, faith, hope, despondency, as you might expect from an intelligent person behind bars, who was also reading voraciously, whatever he could lay his hands on, and making contact with one or two persons who wished him well. Including one or two outside the prison walls. For example, one person whom he mentions, even in these early poems, is Don Giuseppe Zamit Brighella, who was a Latinist, a famous Latinist, and also a newspaper editor. And he obviously knew him and respected him greatly, and he dedicates a poem to him called La Vie, which is a philosophy of life, basically, questioning what the purpose of life is, in French, by the way. Perfect French. And what is amazing, and Joe Brincat actually brought this out, said, it's amazing. His command of Italian is amazing, you know, the register, you know. In fact, he's trying to use an archaic high Italian, probably to show, as Oliver Frigiri suggested to me, that he was nothing less than any of the, you know, best people. He may have been a convict, he may have been a street urchin, you know, scunizzo or whatever, but now he was, you know, moving up in the social ladder. So he could express himself in literary forms, which were of the highest order.
These poems that you've just published, they were written when he was how old?
Well, the first one that I could lay my hands on, because I was very lucky to, first of all, to recognize the handwriting in this pile of manuscripts, which very kindly Baron Gino Trapanegala invited to go and inspect at his house in Gubbio, you know. But when I recognized the handwriting, I said, hey, you know, I recognize this handwriting, you know, I don't know about the others because of the pile of them. They are dated as well as signed. Many of them are signed and dated, which again is another fantastic aspect of the finding, you know.
Cool.
And I could recognize his signature, obviously, and it's dated in his own hand, dated in his own hand. So the first ones go back to the early 1880s, and in one of them he actually says that he was not yet 22, so he was 21. He's barely coming of age, in other words. It's 3 years after he had been locked up. So in 3 years, 3 or 4 years, this person had not only become literate, he had become an artist of sorts. I mean, he was writing poetry, not perhaps the greatest poetry on earth, but poetry which rhymes and not always followed the typical classical styles of the sonnet and so on, because he was inventive and experimental even with the styles in which he used. But clearly writing in impeccable orthography in three languages, and I think from the point of view of content, in fact I subtitled the book The Mech's Lost Prison Poems, Preamble to a Life of Militancy. So it's a preamble, and I ended my talk at the St. Anton in the launch by saying that there's so much more to be said, but clearly the writing was on the wall, as we now know, because if you search what he was saying and how he was saying it, his sentiments, his thoughts, his aspirations, even in this at this early stage, with the advantage of hindsight, of course.
Yes, of course.
You get an inkling of you know, his support for his support all the time, even if he's writing about a frog, a spider and an ant, he supports the ant against the spider.
I was fascinated by some of the titles, which again are perhaps echoes of some classical poems of other people, Voltaire and others. But in the list of poems, Il canto del pastore, pazienza, l'ape, alla formica. These yes. are, they give you a sense of the philosophy that was going on in his mind at that time.
He loved nature, yes. and he has one poem which is early. I mean, the RSPCA had been formed in England, but in Malta, I think it was from what was quite early. Sul maltrattamento degli animali, condemning ill treatment, cruelty to animals. So he saw animals, all kinds, including insects, as part of God's creation, which should be respected and honored, you know,
very
and
Franciscan.
Treated with respect and so on. In fact, Oliver Frigeri, in his back page comment, says very clearly, he read all the poems for me, he says, the discovery and publication of the Max Prison poems will further show how consistently, well, that's all right, that's about my wife, but this collection is indeed a revelation in all respects. It manifests the Max's ability in handling Italian and poetic techniques and highlights his fundamental beliefs, particularly his deep religious conviction and his respect for animals.
Interesting.
So this is one of the interesting aspects of it, you know, and he uses animals even to criticize hypocrisy, pretense, you know, for example, the donkey who pretends he is a horse, but then he is found out that he's a horse after all, makes a fool of himself, you know. So in other words, they're didactic, you know, there's a message. He's basically saying, listen, don't try to pretend something, to be someone whom you're not. And he is obviously very critical of the powerful, those who have power, who abuse of power,
yes.
and very courageous, you know, even here. I mean, for example, one of his famous exhortations, which we use for the frontispiece of the book, the Max Lost Prison Poems, E forti non temer, don't be afraid of the powerful. Don't you be afraid of the powerful. In other words, you can see there maybe a slight touch of the anarchist, even, if you like. I mean, when I first spoke to Mintoff about the Mac, he told me he was an anarchist.
Mm.
And I tried to dissuade him that he wasn't quite an anarchist, you know.
Not
he was critical of the establishment.
Exactly.
And he was shocked.
He was shocked at the at the injustice, the social injustice that he could see in his native, say, Valletta. Where
in his own life. I mean, here he was, you know, running around the streets trying to make a living. Yes,
his father died when he was young.
He was an orphan. His mother tried to make do. He had other siblings, you know. He lived in Talganj, Strada San Giovanni, just opposite the house of Nerik Mitzvah, same street, across the street, in fact. But obviously belonging to a somewhat different social class formation, because obviously Nerik Mitzvah's father was a lawyer, and his grandfather was a magistrate from Gold. Whereas I think the Mac's family went down in social mobility rather than up.
They'd fallen on hard times.
I think so, yes, because they were known as Talis Kultur, because his ancestry, I haven't gone into detail into his ancestry, but if his great father, grandfather, or great-grandfather was Vincenzo de Mec, who's a famous sculptor who did the St. Publius, statue, for example, and so on. Also the fact that we're not talking of a time when you had widows and orphans pensions or anything, you know, so if your husband dies, you've had it,
That's
you know.
It.
Do, become a washerwoman.
There was abject poverty, I mean, there was...
Of course there was abject poverty, because there was no legislative provision to counter it yet. Here we are in the mid-19th century. I mean, the Mac was born in 1860.
Your introduction is entitled The Poetics of Hope and Despondency. And how much did de Mec manage, in fact, to cope with the demon of despondency and keep a lighter ray of hope?
I think one way in which he tries to cope is by writing poems. I think poetry fills a void. Yeah, it's a solace. He also expresses deep faith in God as the creator, and so he's clearly a theist. And one or two poems, particularly the one about the Blessed Virgin, are epitomes of piety, you know, really. So this faith in God, I think, kept him going as well, together with the solace of writing poetry. He also tried to keep in touch with others who had either left prison, such as a Gibraltarian Maltese who continues to write letters to him from Spain, from Gibraltar, but also outside the prison walls, tried to keep track of what was going on outside. Because the 1880s, of course, were a very seminal period in Maltese history. I mean, you have the rise of nationalism, huge meetings and demonstrations and so on. He seemed to have an inkling of what was going on. Also, through the prison chaplains and pastors, he must have had other sounding boards with whom he exchanged views and and from whom he learned a lot, because, I mean, there's no way in which he could have reached this level of linguistic proficiency without a lot of dedication from people who wished him well. And it was very encouraging to see a prisoner who had such native intelligence and such a will to reform, to change, to rehabilitate. So I think anybody with any sense of social well-being and goodness would feel very encouraged and motivated to help such a person, which I think is what happened, in fact.
Since we're discussing these poems, I'd love you to read perhaps first verse of the one that struck you most, perhaps, of all of them, if you can. I mean,
well, there are various poems. One which I find very romantic, in fact, possibly escapist. It's called Il Canto del Pastore, which is a pastoral, really, sort of Oliver Goldsmith words, where, you know, pastoral. Pace è il vero mio tesoro, non ambisco gemme d'oro. So this kind of reasoning, where inner peace is far more profitable to man than riches, you know, than wealth. He also actually writes about the word, the uses which can be made of the word, good use and bad use of the word. And he says, if you make bad use of words, if you use words to instigate, to provoke, you better shut up. He says, metacer che parlar, better shut up than speak, than say anything, you know. Again, he has another poem called Pazienza, in which, I don't know if this is a premonition of things to come or a reflection on things past, but he's basically saying, look, he says, I'm resolved to suffer any injustice, any suffering, any provocation, and not react to it. He loves birds. He writes poems to birds, to the passero, to the colomba, the dove. And he is fascinated by bird song, almost idealizing it as a form of supernatural behavior, you know. For example, the singing of his canary, you know.
I see more than one about his canary here.
Yes, he writes about list. Birds. There are at least six poems here which are about birds. Ehi che canto, what a song, you know. Sto piangendo per sfogare la mia rabbia. I'm crying to give vent to my anger. Me meskin, poor fellow. Could be himself, huh?
Yes.
This could be a metaphor, huh? Because he's, you know, in a cage. Mia vita spendo dentro questa angusta gabbia. I spend my entire life in this bloody cage, you know? In this restricted cage, angusta. Degno son d'esser compianto. I really deserve being pitied. Malevetta vita mia, you know? Sempre chiuso in crudo ferro. Always closed in this crude iron, iron bars, you know? So the song, he says, the bird song makes the cell come alive with meaning and significance, you know. So that's one way in which he answers your question, how, you know, did he respond to responding?
Yes,
how did
yes.
he cope?
You mentioned the religious convictions. They're still evident at this time, definitely. You mentioned the Stabat Mater poem, and it seems that he had this feeling of spirituality,
yes,
even if he wasn't terribly keen on the institutionalized church.
No, less and less so, but I think it is a real shame to think of the Mac in terms of being anti-Christian or an antichrist, because he certainly was inspired by the scriptures. He quotes them repeatedly, even in later life, in Il Bandiera Tal Maltin, you know, idealistically. So spirituality is very much a part of him. And it is partly, I think, his motivation also in what he does in life. So I think it's very unfair. There are many internal contradictions. I mean, when he gets excommunicated, one of those who most supports him is the Protestant Alliance. The Protestant Alliance had a magazine called Protestant Alliance Magazine. Now, the Mac was very anti-colonialist, was even a Republican, but the motto of this magazine was Protestantism, the secret of England's greatness. And they were, of course, supporting him because he had been excommunicated by the Roman Catholic bishop. Of course, anti-Catholicism being part and parcel of English nationalism, this fits into the picture, but looking at it locally, it jarred. The Mac was influenced by the Enlightenment. So he believed in le citoyen, the citizen who should stand up for his own rights and not be afraid.
Unfortunately, coming to the end of our time, there's so much more one could say. There have been many roads named after Manuel de Mec, and then there's the monument to Castile and several commemorative plaques at the port and at Oromi. De Mec has clearly become now part of Malta's history and probably part of you yourself.
Also,
so how do you feel
force
about
of, by
him?
By force of circumstance, you
You've
know,
become very friendly with him over the years.
I never knew I was striking such a hornet's nest. when I first wrote about him, but then it became increasingly evident to me that I had actually struck one, you know, a big one too. But then finally, I must say, in spite of his excommunication and him being a convict and so on, because Mintoff told me, keep me informed of what you're finding, you know. Because he knew this about being an anarchist from one of his supporters. So I did that. And then suddenly, when the Labour Party returned to office in 1971, the MEC, from an anarchist, became an icon. He had trouble with the church, like the Labour Party, like Strickland's party, so there's a certain empathy there, you know. He was saying things which favoured the worker, you know, the weak and so on. So it fitted the bill, and all of a sudden he was actually made almost into a supporter of the Labour Party, which of course had not even been founded when he died.
But now, 40 years on from that moment, work, academic works such as yours and others who have looked into other aspects have given us a rounded picture of
I think so, and he's been accepted, I think, by all sides, and although initially he was given this partisan dimension, which does not altogether fit him, in some respects it does, but in some others it doesn't, because de Meck was a left-wing nationalist. I mean, as one of his great admirers and followers told me, he would have opposed integration policy tooth and nail. And to the extent that there was continuity with the Labour Party, it would have been ruptured at that stage, certainly, because, you know, he always believed that if we had to quarrel with Britain, if Britain left us or disappointed us, we should go our own way and be a republic. And he also had this duality, you know, love your Maltese brother even if he hurts you, but don't never love the foreigner, hate the foreigner, you know. So it's a nationalistic, very nationalistic.
Well, come to the end of our time this morning. I'd like to thank Professor Henry Frindle for coming to talk to us about his latest book, De Meck's Lost Prison Poems. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġġu plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.